Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:32 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is November 27th, and it being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off today with the 10-year break-even rate for 10-year treasuries, because it's at 1.75%. And on both an absolute and relative basis, it's noteworthy, because on the one hand, it's still rising, and it firmed in here today. Now, the break-even rate, perhaps the easiest way to think about it is, it's the rate at which bonds would have to be if they were going to outpace the risk from inflation. So, at 1.75%, against a background where the 10-year Treasury is at 83 basis points and contracted in here today, then there's a significant pickup. And in other words, we've got 90 basis points, give or take, of negative real interest rates. But then there's the additional point that back in early 2011 and 12, the break-even rate was, give or take, around 2%. So that's noteworthy, because it was back then we had the peak in the precious metal price. And then when we look at the same chart for the 10-year treasury yield, well, it was also around 2%. So there wasn't this nearly the same worry about a negative real interest rate, or the negative real interest rates that had supported gold had basically been completely eroded. Then there was the fact the dollar was on the cusp of bottoming a decade ago, and it really then appreciated a lot versus emerging markets in particular. Well, we're at the rather opposite situation today. So back then, break-even rates and the 10-year rate were almost the same. And today, well, interest rates are significantly below where they were in 2000, and 10-year yields are significantly below where they were at the turn of the year in 2011 and 12. So that is a very significant issue. Then when we think about the yield on tips, now it's been argued over the last 6 months that tips are not the most are the best way of monitoring demand for inflation hedges because it's not especially liquid. But the Treasury is still issuing them. And then when we look at the yield, it pulled back in here this week in a reasonably dynamic manner, and it has confirmed resistance for the yield in the region of the trend mean. Well, this is still a clear downward bias, and it really does suggest that there is ample demand for an inflation hedge. But the number one thing we would anticipate from inflation would be higher government bond yields, because the reality is that longer dated treasuries are allergic to inflation. So if we are to have inflation, then it would be logical, at least, to think that those inflationary pressures should start to show up in the government bond markets first. But we're not seeing that, and there's a good reason for that. It's because of the size of the debts. And the yield curve spread is currently around 68 basis points. When we look at that on a daily basis, we have ample examples now since May of it pulling back from the 70 basis point level, and it finished on the lower side of its little range in here today. I think that it is really quite likely that we're going to see the Federal Reserve engage in outright yield curve control. They don't really have a lot of choice. The size of government bond debts has exploded in the last year. And unfortunately, let me see if I can find some of these charts. The reality is that, for example, the dollar is overvalued versus some of the emerging markets ex-China. And obviously the Chinese renminbi has rallied significantly in here over the last few months, But it's still at a point where the emerging markets could significantly do better against the US dollar. When we then think about just how much debt is outstanding, then it's really quite profound. And this is another example here, that when we think about emerging market debt, well, there is a great deal of it needs to be refinanced in 2021. So this is about as opportune a time as one might imagine, that one could wish for, that we would see those currencies start to appreciate. One of the biggest risks that's been outlined by investors over the course of the last decade has been the risk from US dollar denominated debt outside of the USA. And that's particularly the case for emerging markets. They have had to go for external funding because of the weakness of their currencies. And then with the dollar strengthening over a prolonged period of time, it has raised the prospect of of really significant debt issues. And we have already seen that there have been significant debt issues in the emerging markets, whether that is in Turkey or in excuse me, in Lebanon or Zambia, Venezuela or Argentina. All of those places have had debt issues so far this year, but there's a great deal of debt that needs to be refinanced next year. We're certainly seeing that earnings in the emerging markets are starting to improve, but their currencies are now also starting to recover, and that should help to offset the risk from refinancing. If they can refinance their debt at accommodative levels, particularly against a background where there are extraordinarily low interest rates on the global front, then the risk from emerging markets is likely to be considerably less next year than it has been overall. One of the particular reasons that people might have been worried about it, therefore, is looking considerably less worrisome as we look into 2021 and beyond, because it's really 2021 is where the majority of the debt is going to come due. But there's lots of other worry about debt, and I think that those are some of the most important questions when we think about the negative real interest rate environment. One of the most important things that people are going to be really considering is how long is it likely to last for? Well, I find this particularly interesting because debt as a percentage of GDP on a global basis pretty much went sideways from about 2016 through until 2019. Now, the quantity of debt outstanding rose, but not faster than GDP. But then we look at the quantity of debt that has been taken on this year. Well, it has jumped higher, in the order of approximately 20 trillion. But it happened against a background where economies were in sharp contraction. So debt to GDP jumped by a very significant margin. And it's anticipated that we're likely to see a very significant increase in debt again over the course of the next couple of years, though perhaps not quite as swift as we've had on a debt to GDP ratio basis going forward, because GDP is likely to improve, even though debt totals will continue to rise. But on a global debt basis, we're looking at almost $280 trillion and 370% of GDP. It does, of course, beg the question, what on earth is going to have to happen in order to reset this phenomenal debt accumulation? And it has only been going one way for decades. That is probably the biggest long-term question that we might even begin to think about. But the one thing we certainly know is that populations are already restive, and the range of outcomes that are possible has been significantly limited as a result of the decisions made in the aftermath of the financial crisis. So, for example, in the USA, they went through this horrific foreclosure crisis where millions of people were kicked out of their homes. Now, regardless of the basis under which people were able to attain mortgages, which was obviously entirely too lax, the fact that whole families found themselves on the street and struggling in the aftermath of the foreclosure crisis, that was probably one of the causal events in the rise of populism in the USA. If we then think about this massive quantity of money that is still outstanding, well, in terms of the ability of people to pay their mortgage or to keep up with their rent, there is approximately a third of all people are behind on one or the other. There is just no way that the USA is going to go through another eviction crisis. And because the magnitude of this problem this time around is so much larger than the foreclosure crisis, it's not going to happen. So it's all well and good to call it a dark winter, but the reality is that there is no politician is going to have it on their record that they evicted millions of people from their abodes. And therefore, the chances of the USA moving into a period of fiscal austerity is zero. There is just no way that any democratic society is going to, in fact, endure that kind of duress on people that are already struggling. And especially so because people have endured it once already. There is just no way that restive populations are going to even come close to tolerating a suggestion of fiscal austerity. That's why I'm so convinced we're going to have yield curve control, because the US federal government cannot afford to have higher yields. If 200 basis points were added to the 10-year Treasury yield off the lows from earlier this year, taking it up to approximately 2.25%, it would add $100 billion to the debt service costs of the debt. And that's more than they spend on education. And so it's just impossible that they're going to tolerate that in the absence of outsized growth and inflation. So the Federal Reserve is not going to raise interest rates regardless of what the inflation figure is. And when we then think about the different types of inflation, well, it's really clear that we've had significant monetary inflation. M2, for example, has gone vertical this year, and it is still rising. So, the quantity of money that's been printed to deal with this recession has been incredibly profound. But what we're now also starting to see is that it is feeding through into commodity prices. So, the chances are here that we have seen the bottom in the commodity cycle. Commodity prices have been coming down now for a decade already. They've now rallied enough to break the sequence of lower rally highs. And this is really very similar to the kinds of conditions that we had back in 2001 and 2 and 3. Because it was back then that I was first introduced to the way of thinking that governments were going to completely devalue their currencies, and that we were going to move into a situation where they were going to hold interest rates down for a prolonged period in order to stoke growth, and that that was likely to have some form of inflationary pressures. Well, the inflation that we saw was commodity price inflation. In the last decade, because of this massive surge in money supply, without the credit facilities in banks really starting or in a, really able to lend, we haven't had the kind of inflation that central banks in fact have, and commodity prices have also helped to contain inflationary pressures over the last decade. But as we look forward, if we think about the different kinds of inflation, well, on the one hand, there is monetary inflation, and we have plenty of that. Then we also have also had significant inflation in domestic services, whether that is in the UK, in Europe, or in the USA, in Australia or Canada. Services prices have increased, and real estate prices have increased because of this direct response to the increase in the monetary base. We've also seen that art prices and prices for collectibles have done phenomenally well. There is massive media coverage, for example, of these car auctions and these stories about wrecks of cars being found in barns and being done up and sold for extraordinary sums. Well, that is a wholly new phenomenon that really only arose as a result of the monetary inflation. But then, as we look forward, there are other kinds of inflation, because if we move back into a commodity price environment where commodities are rising, well, then that is likely to be a source of input inflation, and that starts to put pressure on prices of goods. So we've had services inflation for sure over the course of the last decade. We haven't had goods inflation, but with a weaker dollar and higher commodity prices and stronger currencies in Asia in particular, then there is going to be a significant push-pull in exactly who is going to benefit from this inflation, because either producers are going to have to accept lower margins, or consumers are going to have to accept higher prices, or we're going to see both. And there is obviously going to be some give and take in terms of this, because commodity prices have really only just begun to move. And they are still only at levels that prevailed way back in 2007. The big difference on this occasion is that the defining characteristic of a commodity bull market is a rise in the marginal cost of production. And that's exactly what happened during the last super cycle. So now the big question is, in terms of supply and demand, on the one hand, we need to first have a clear indication of where is new demand going to come from. What is the thing that is going to create additional demand to put upward pressure on prices and subsequently then create a supply response? Well, I guess there are two big ones. The first is global reflation. When we think about the fact that there are these massive debts, the only possible way that governments are ever going to get on top of them is either to, and I think probably simultaneously, devalue their currencies and try to reflate their economies. Well, that's obviously what they're going to do, because there is no country is going to default on those debts, particularly any country that has been able to issue debt in its own currency and has control over printing that currency. So they never default, but they're certainly going to print as much currency as they deem necessary. On that basis alone, the reflation trade is likely to go into overdrive. Now, when we then think about, well, what are the sectors that will benefit from that? Well, we've certainly seen that industrials are really quite steady in here, and we've seen that the sector itself has done particularly well and is pushing on to new recovery highs. But then, when we think about some of the household name type industrials, well, they're only just beginning to turn around. At 3M, for example, has been trending downwards for about 3 or 4 years and is just steadying. GE is a shade of the behemoth that it was back in the early 2000s, and it is just at the beginning of potentially starting to recover. Rolls-Royce collapsed off the back of the coronavirus pandemic, and it is just on the cusp of starting to recover here. So there is the clear potential that we're going to see a significant number of these big industrial companies starting to do better as we hit global reflation. Some, of course, have been doing much better than others. Illinois Tool Works, for example, is a dividend aristocrat, and they haven't really had to bother with cutting their dividends. There are still plenty of companies that did not cut their dividends this year, and well, let's just think about it. If they didn't have to cut their dividend in 2020, the chances are that they're not going to have to. When we think about around the world, then this drive towards significantly lower interest rates and the permanence of that condition, the clear potential that the 10-year yield will be either will have difficulty getting back above the 1% level or will be curtailed from doing so is a very real possibility. And it is going to create a premium on growth. It will also create a premium on security and yield. So that is obviously then going to create a demand for real assets, whether those assets are property or whether we're talking about fundamental commodities to the global economy. Then, of course, there is the potential for reflation. And what exactly is it that governments are going to do in order to try and get the millions of people that are out of work and back into gainful employment? Well, so far, the clearest beneficiaries have been the renewables. So, for example, the wind sector continues to break up and out of what is effectively a 10-year base formation. And a lot of these ETFs really only started to come into existence just before the crash. So we don't have a lot of historical comparisons for what we could anticipate in terms of the recovery, but they are still rising. Vestas Wind Systems is one of the companies that's been around somewhat longer, and it has been one of the primary beneficiaries of the demand for wind turbines. There is approximately 3 tons of copper in a wind turbine that is capable of producing 1 megawatt of energy, of electricity. And that's a lot of wind turbines, and it's a lot of copper. So copper prices broke out to new 6, almost 7 year highs in here today. So there is the clear scope that copper and some of the industrial resources are going to be the prime beneficiaries of this global reflation trend on the very basic just demand for infrastructure and factories that fueled some of the last recoveries. Well, that's obviously then going to help the industrial resources, but then this transition to renewable sources of energy is also a very significant factor. Then when we think about the aluminium price, if we think about the demand for ultra high voltage transmission lines and excuse me, China is investing heavily in that sector. They've been doing so for most of the last few years, and the aluminium price has also rebounded really quite impressively from its lows. Then when we think about lithium, well, It's not the easiest price to monitor, but it does look like it has broken its downtrend. And when we then think about some of the lithium producers, the pure plays have also broken their downtrends. So we are now moving into a period where a lot of the new supply that was brought into the market in 2016 and 17 is finally being soaked up. There is massive investment in additional new supply of gigafactories. So I think that's an additional point. And I'm just going to start closing some of these charts. But the big question here is, when are we in fact going to see these bigger trends starting to really gain investor interest? One thing I've learned from talking to people, other people in the newsletter writing business, is that they don't generally sell as many subscriptions at the beginning of a trend as they do at the end. And at the end, and well past the peak, that's when they see the greatest demand for their newsletters. Because it's very simple. That's when most people understand the theme. It's when everybody has seen the evidence of the gains already. And that is then when they want to invest. Whereas what we're seeing today is that there is certainly interest in renewable energy because it has been doing well over the last few years. But the only reason that it started to really ignite interest is because it has been doing well. But the really big change that happened in the renewable energy sector was at the end of 2019, because it was back then that the sector had just begun to break on the upside. And that was against a background where the oil price had been going down. So we have now seen a clear change that the solar sector is now good enough. The batteries sector is now good enough. And the wind sector is also good enough that governments and consumers can get an alternative to the oil price. Because the reality is that today they are marching to their own tune. And that is what is starting to really ignite interest, that they are exhibiting such clear relative strength that it is starting to ignite interest in the potential that this is the big new thing. But there is the additional point that if we're looking for a real causal factor behind what exactly is going on here, well, it's really all about China. Because China is now the biggest producer of batteries as of 2018. It's going to hold on to that market share and increase it further by 2023 just by virtue of the projects that are already underway. And they're likely to continue building out for most of the rest of the decade. When we listen to what Tesla has been saying at their battery day, because there was a lot of anticipation that Tesla would announce the evolution of a solid-state battery or a step change in the efficiency of batteries, and they did not do that. Instead, what Tesla did at their battery day in September was to lay out in concrete terms how they were going to halve the cost of their cars. And that was all about production efficiencies. In order to get to 1,000-mile ranges in cars, there's going to have to be a step change in terms of the ability, or I guess in the technology, because lithium ion is not going to get us to 1,000-mile ranges. But it can get us to 500-mile ranges, and Then it could also get to a point where we're going to have much more demand for electric vehicles, just on the basis of the technology that exists today and the efficiency gains that can be produced from the technology just being perfected in terms of manufacturing. And China is driving that. Not only are they doing it because they wish to capture market share in an emerging technology, which of course they want to do, but China's also by far the largest automotive market. So they're following the same kind of evolutionary path that Japan did and South Korea did. Both Japan and South Korea started off as very low-end manufacturers. They very intentionally moved up the value chain and developed domestic automotive sectors and then started exporting those cars around the world. China obviously is not only looking at potentially exporting vehicles, but it also has its own large domestic market to service. And the last thing that they want to do is to become completely reliant on imported oil. And the price of oil today is not a headwind to growth. At $48 on Brent crude, it is towards the lower side of the range over the course of the last decade. But if China's automotive demand were to continue, then they would be signing up to be indentured in terms of their reliance on energy imports indefinitely. And given the Chinese administration's long-term ambitions, there is just no way that they're going to allow themselves to become completely dependent on energy imports. Therefore, it is extremely likely that as we move into the next decade, the primary focus of the energy sector in China is going to be towards renewables. It's going to be towards domestic power generation and towards battery transportation, because it will free them from a reliance on imported oil. Now, the oil price today is rebounding, and that's a clear reflection of investors willing to give the benefit of the doubt to recovering global GDP next year. We are going to see a significant input in terms of batteries. Or excuse me, I'm going to see a significant throughput of recovery and vaccines. And that is the reflation trade is absolutely necessary because of the quantity of debt. When we think about the size of government debt and the quantity of debt that's been taken on in just the period from the fourth quarter of 2019 through to the third quarter of 2020, then Canada, Japan, the USA, and UK have been among the most aggressive in terms of jumping up in terms of their debt to GDP ratios. So, for example, the UK's debt to GDP ratio has jumped by 30% in that period during the lockdown. Canada's even more, and China's about the same as the UK. It's also worth highlighting that the vast majority of emerging markets have seen their debt loads increase much less than developed markets. That also helps to highlight how much less of an impact the coronavirus has had on the emerging markets. That is just another example of where the demographic dividend has really come to bear. That's, I think, one of the more important facts that is likely to be most acutely paid attention to as people think about where is money going to flow next year. Because it's likely to flow into reflation trades, into the renewable energy sector, primarily because of China and Europe's determination on both a domestic front, an environmental front, but also on a geopolitical front to pursue energy independence because the USA has successfully achieved energy independence. If we just simply look at what the USA has achieved in terms of oil production went from about 6 million barrels to about 15 to 16 million barrels in the space of 12 years. And against that background, both Russia and Saudi Arabia's supply was relatively static, and Mexico, Canada, and Norway's production pretty much fell for that entire duration. This has raised, and it's an absolute game changer in terms of global geopolitics. So it has obviously been a clear benefit for the US economy. It has allowed the US to be much more isolationist in terms of their geopolitical view, because they don't have to secure the global oil sector when they are a net exporter themselves. And then, of course, because of that, then the response of major importers like the EU and China to that ability of the USA to cut themselves out of global agreements and depend less on the need for playing along to get along. Well, now Europe and China have to also look towards energy independence on a purely selfish geopolitical basis. That is going to be a government phenomenon. Then, when we think about currencies, well, among the most undervalued currencies as of today are all commodity producers. And this is, I think, in sharp contrast to some of those that are rather expensive. So we have the clear scope that a number of the commodity producing currencies are going to at least appreciate versus the US dollar. And that was also something that we saw in the early 2000s. So, for example, the Brazilian real, it looks increasingly like the low for, or at least the dollar's peak, is probably going to be around the six level, and that it is looking increasingly likely that this is a type 2 top with right-hand extension characteristics. The South African rand has also at least found near-term support, and it's looking increasingly likely that the dollar has peaked, and the rand has now strengthened through the 200-day moving average, and it is back in the region of 15, which is the upper side of this range that persisted between 2018 and 19. Well, the rand is a little overbought in the short term. We may see some consolidation, but against a background where there is increasing demand for commodities, then South Africa is likely to benefit. But then, when we think about the Australian dollar, it trended down for what felt like an awfully long time from the peak in 2011, and now it is firming from the 70 cent level and the region of the trend mean. It has broken its downtrend. Well, Australia is engaged in a tit for tat, I guess, a war of words and mild sanctions with China right now. But China is putting tariffs on Australian wine. It's not putting tariffs on Australian gas or coal or metallurgical coal. It's certainly not putting tariffs on vital food products. The reality is that it isn't simply that we're seeing inflation in commodity prices like copper and oil, but soybeans are now up to 1,200 cents. This is looking increasingly like a clear base formation completion. Wheat prices have sustained the breakout, and while not able to hold all of the gain in here this week, this looks like the completion of what is effectively a 6-year base formation. It's also worth reminding ourselves that in terms of the rising cost of production, then it isn't just that we've had a step change in oil or in copper over the course of the period from 2000 through to 2008, but that all of the agricultural commodities also took a step higher. And even if we are in a range that persists in a manner similar to between 1973 and 2004, well, we're at the lower side of that range, and the price could almost double from here before even beginning to break out of this range. So we are probably in for a great deal more commodity price appreciation and volatility over the course of the next few years. Not only do we have the demand from a recovering global economy, but there have also been significant supply disruptions this year because of the pandemic and because of weather. One thing that has been a very significant factor in the Gulf this year has been the number of hurricanes, and named storms is at an historic high. But much more important than that is something we've seen over at least the last 3 years, which is that hurricanes have tended to intensify very abruptly in the 24 hours before they make landfall. This year alone, we saw it happen twice. It certainly happened, I think, last year with Hurricane Harvey in Houston. But the Iota hurricane that made landfall in Central America just this month was a Category 2 hurricane, and within 24 hours, it had intensified to a Category 5 before making landfall. That rapid intensification is obviously a significant challenge because it makes them extremely difficult to predict, and it greatly increases the cost. And that's a factor as well in the continued demand for lumber. And lumber prices had not, to any great extent, participated in the big run-up in commodities from 2002 onwards. In fact, we've only just seen it move into a new price strata. And when we think about why that might be, well, we've had the supply disruptions, but the reality is that you cannot bring new supply of lumber to market in the short term. When there are massive fires and increasing demand for building materials, and then a rather difficult environment on the global stage, then there is the clear scope here that this rebound from the $500 level for lumber prices may in fact be sustained. There is quite likely to be a great deal of home building over the course of the next decade. A lot of the spare capacity in the aftermath of the foreclosure crisis has already been taken up, and home builders are still holding their breakout to new recovery highs. The other significant factor in terms of an inflationary outlook is banks. Banks have repaired their balance sheets in the USA, for example. Now, that is not true yet in Europe. Europe is still dealing with their own series of bad debts, but the bad debt issue was solved in the USA, and the banks are therefore better capitalized overall. They're in a much better position to greatly enhance their pass-through of credit, or to engage in the credit multiplier effect that is the basis for their entire business. And they're not paying interest rates right now, but they do get to charge for loans. So while the yield curve spread is currently holding around 70 basis points, banks are making more than that. They've also had their operations backstopped by the government. So when we think about whether we're likely to have inflation, we already have the monetary inflation. We are likely to have the commodity price inflation. But the one kind of inflation that has been missing for most of the last decade has been the credit inflation. Well, arguably, we've had a lot of credit taken out by the corporations of the world. High yield spreads are still contracting. They're down now to 384 basis points, which has completely unwound the spike higher from earlier this year. The leverage among the most indebted of those types of companies has increased rather substantially. That's, I think, particularly true when we look at some of the high yield debt. So the median quartile and the high end of the quartile are still, it's median and the low quartile are still in the reasonable stage of leverage. It's the high quartile of high yield net debt to EBITDA. This is, some companies have taken on massive debt in this year. And that means that as long as governments are willing to backstop that debt, well, probably people aren't going to be all that worried. And the high yield sector is still in the region of its peaks. But the reality is that this is just a sector that is going to continue to take on leverage and will then become a very significant problem in terms of when governments eventually do have to raise interest rates. But the bond market, and certainly when we think about what corporations are doing, they're taking on money because it's virtually free, and they may in fact benefit from the reduced purchasing power of currencies, because governments are going to do whatever it takes to reflate. There's no way they're going to raise interest rates, and there is going to be ample supports for various parts of the economy in order to avoid what could effectively be revolutions. Companies might actually come out the other end of that in better form because they have got the ability to pay down their debts in a diminishing currency. So while gold prices have been softer over the course of the last 3 months, they're now right in the region of the trend mean. There is a contract expiry coming up, and sometimes, not every time certainly, but sometimes around contract expiries, you start to see some interest around, could they potentially push down the price before delivery in order to minimize losses. Well, the most active contract right now is February, but we are starting to see that liquidity is moving out of the December and into those Februarys, and then January is not a liquid contract at all. As we move towards delivery, well, we can also see then that the active contract is defaulting here to the February contract. So if we look at the December contract, why didn't that work? Oops. GCZ0. I'm sorry, I'm being inarticulate as I'm trying to get this up. We can see that the last trade will be the 29th of December, and liquidity is starting to come out of it already. We can certainly think about the fact that we're in the region of the trend mean. We know that gold prices tend to overshoot. It's really a lot of fun when they overshoot on the upside. They also have a tendency to overshoot on the downside. We had an example of that back in 2018, where prices were on the cusp of clearing the $1,400 level and then gave up all of that advance and then substantially more of it before subsequently recovering. Well, the reality then is we'll need to see a clear upward dynamic to confirm a return to demand dominance, but against a background of the clear intention of governments to devalue their currencies, then it's hard to imagine why gold should be weak. Gold shares do appear to at least be finding support in the region of the trend mean. $30 represents the upper side of the underlying base formation. So this could really be a first step above the base. It would be tempting to think that the entire bull market has already run its course, and what I've seen recently have been a number of news items which have discussed the possibility that gold prices would start to come back after the pandemic. They seem to ignore the fact that gold popped on the upside in 2016, and it popped on the upside in 2019, and that it was on the cusp of breaking out before the pandemic. So it didn't rally just because of the pandemic. But the reality is that it is rallying for the simple fact that we have negative real interest rates, that negative real interest rates are likely to persist for the lengthy medium term because the dollar is breaking down. And this is probably the big factor that is starting to come to fruition this week. The dollar has looked susceptible to weakness since March. The USA is printing more money than anybody else. And whether one wants to take that on an absolute basis or take it based simply on the size of the economy relative to everybody else's, the USA is printing more money than anyone else. And that is coming on the back of some of the most aggressive pro-cyclical policies ever embarked upon during an expansion. So instead of cutting back on spending in the late cycle of the last expansion, the USA instead just printed money with abandon. So in order to curtail the risks on this occasion, they've had to go into overdrive, and the quantity of debt has been spectacular. Of course, that is a truly global phenomenon. The number of central banks around the world with interest rates below 1% is up to about 60%. So again, that is just another phenomenal example of just how low interest rates are, how indebted governments are, and perhaps most importantly, how unable they are to service or pay back those debts. And the only way that they're going to be able to achieve any of their goals is to increase debt in the short term, devalue their currencies, do anything to stoke reflationary pressures. But the reality is that some places are much better positioned to come out of the coronavirus than others. Emerging markets are at a position today that they haven't been at really in nearly 20 years. Their currencies are starting to appreciate. Then, when we think about the resilience of their economies, they've come through the coronavirus in much better form than either Europe or North America. The Korean market has rebounded in very emphatic fashion. It's an example of a market that had been doing well ahead of the virus and then has recouped those declines, or excuse, recouped the peaks. But the South Korean market had been ranging for a decade. Taiwan is another place that has come through the pandemic in very strong form, and the market is pushing up and out of a 30-year base formation. Then, when we think about Japan, it has been the poster child for deflation for the lengthy medium term, and the Nikkei has now cleared the 25,000 level. It has completed that first step above the base, and it is pushing on to new high ground. We're quite likely to be back in normal lives before the summer of next year. Virus fears are likely to abate. I started writing about and talking about the peak of viral hysteria back in September, and I do think that that was the peak of hysteria. We're still in a fairly hysterical environment, but it's not as bad as it was then. Predictably, we've had an uptick in the number of cases, but the death rates have come nowhere close to approximating the levels in March of this year. As we come out of this particular phase, we're going to start to see vaccines rolled out and economies are going to rebound. There is this massive source of pent-up demand for everything that is likely to really stoke demand for exporting economies. That's also part of the reason why, despite the fact that Germany has gone through this epic period of supplementing incomes for workers, that the DAX index is right on the cusp of breaking on the upside. Then, when we think about the Chinese market, I think it is more likely that we're going to see China's stock market remain volatile, but the investment in additional renewable energy is likely to be a more significant factor. The reality is that from an investor's perspective, China is a difficult place to invest, and it's practically impossible to avoid these days because it represents such a large weighting in the emerging markets ETF. And even that is pushing up to the upper side of a 12-year range. These kinds of long-term ranges are the easiest to analyze because they represent periods where demand is pent up and they require a catalyst to really start to create the environment for an explosion waiting to happen. And on this occasion, it is quite likely to be the devaluation of the dollar, the massive amount of money being printed to stoke reflation, and the fact that Asia in particular has come through the coronavirus and pandemic in much better condition than anywhere else. So we are back in a condition where commodity prices and emerging markets are likely to move together because they're some of the biggest producers and consumers of commodities. That the fears about devaluation of currency are likely to continue to stoke demand for gold, and that the bull market is likely to migrate to renewable energy because that is where there is likely to be trillions spent over the next decade. And with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.